we have an economy that's incredible. We have an economy that's so fragile. And the only reason it's running now is it's running off the fumes of what we did, what the Trump administration, it's just running off the fumes. And when there's a crash, I hope it's going to be during this next 12 months, because I don't want to be Herbert Hoover.
Yes, folks, that is Trump there in response to a question from Lou Dobbs about what he wants to do economy-wise for the forgotten man and woman in America. He says, "Don't fuck this up for me. I don't want to be Herbert Hoover." Okay, that's what the forgotten man and woman thinking. Hello, David. Welcome, Left Reckoning 152.
Dude, very happy to be here. I know we were back last week, but feels we're back in the saddle again. Looking forward to 2024.
There's a lethargy that comes with the first week back after Christmas vacation, where it's like, what? Which floor is the studio on? Like,
yeah, exactly.
Just quick note on the economy stuff there. Like, one, on the fumes of what Trump did, I think is a little bit rich. I think the main thing we're seeing is that a lot of the pent-up demand that happened because the economy shut down because of a global pandemic is leading to a massive burst in productivity and economic activity following that. And Biden is, in a sense, riding that. Frustration among liberals, and we just got a different thing with your there you go. Hold on 1 second. Yeah, something's messed up with your mic, David.
Okay, your mic, what are you hearing from me? Because your stuff sounds all wild.
Okay, crap, what's going on here?
Yeah,
all right. Well, anyway, just a quick wrap up that Trump thing, like. Yes, I think, you know, certain things like the IRA or whatever, investments in bridges and roads, those are good. And the $1,400 was good. It would be easier for people to understand the good that Democrats do if Biden wasn't, you know, at the entire time having the Federal Reserve trying to go after the labor market with interest rates, that calling the heat in the labor market the reason for that. And not really coming through with the student loan stuff, despite what Jim Clyburn might want to say. But yeah, that's the situation there with Trump on the economy.
Yeah, and I'm back, right? Everything's good. Okay.
Yeah, and I think it just needed to adjust.
I mean, I'm really looking forward to Joe Biden versus Donald Trump really duking it out. And telling everybody the way that they're going to fight for everyday people, to folks who have shown time and time again that they're not particularly interested in that. And the same with the liberal. I mean, it's been absolutely wild to watch over the past couple of weeks. This new kind of like Twitter fetish, at least for like online libs, which is to sort of act like things aren't costing more for everyday people. That's a real winner of an election strategy, by the way, sort of wagging your fingers at folks who are saying, hey, I'm not feeling too good financially right now.
The rate of inflation went down, so you should feel good about rent costing, $4,200 for a two bedroom. Yeah.
But in fairness, and in the, you know, the spirit of a new year, an election year coming up, I think maybe to open up, we can talk about a little something that has been going on for a while. But I feel like resetting the terrain on it is sort of worthwhile, which is the continued fear mongering around not only immigration, but a particular thing that Donald Trump and the Republicans have been pushing for a while, which is this idea that illegal immigrants are coming into the country and voting and flipping the election. If not for Trump, for maybe for a long ass time they've been doing this. No, I mean, all nonsensical stuff. But let's just sort of walk us through the different versions of this argument, at least from some of the loudest folks out there. And maybe to start with, no one better than the big man himself, Mr. Donald Trump, talking about this in Iowa just the other day. Also, apologies, folks, this is a pulled video from some right-wing influencer guy, so there is going to be some scare cuts in here.
gratuitous, objectification of migrant people.
The last remnants of our open and broken border are crumbling into rubble as millions and millions of people storm into the United States in the largest illegal mass migration in the history of the world. And part of the reason they want them to come in is, in my opinion, they're signing them up to vote. And I believe that's why you're having millions of people pour into our country. And it could very well affect the next election. And I believe that's why they're doing it.
And look, we're focusing on the Twitter here because I think it's very important, actually, because this is where a lot of this stuff is being disseminated, not just from people like Donald Trump, but other elected officials, as we'll get into in a second. And I mean, look, you know, with Trump, it's one of those things where, Trump still denies the election in 2020. Trump will say anything that sort of, you know, inflates his, not just ego, but, you know, whatever he thinks is going to play well with the crowd. There are different versions of this argument, but it's a continued one that I've been hearing this from the right wing for a long time, right, Matt? But typically it was a little bit more of a fringe kind of weird, maybe county sheriff elected official guy or a big Alex Jones fan. How explicit and mainstream it's becoming within the Republican Party should give folks pause. Obviously, Trump has been pushing this for a while. People like Tucker Carlson have been pushing this for a while. Elon Musk, as we're going to get into in a second, have been pushing this for a while. But we've been getting versions of this from the new Speaker of the House, from other members all across the Republican Party, that basically there's this big plot to flip elections by getting illegal migrants, giving illegal migrants the ability to vote.
Yeah, it got our section on with Joe Rogan with Stavros Halkias, a comedian I'm a fan of, nuked by copyright. But that was his argument, which is that look at all these migrants in Chicago. People are protesting it, saying, "Hey, maybe I'll vote for Trump because I hate this so much." And Stav's like, "Well, why do you think they're doing that?" Just a sidebar: the reason they're doing that is because we have an influx of migrants that need to be processed in this country, and rather than letting them stack up at an airport during the holidays, Chicago's trying to find a place to house them. But that's not, you know, available to Joe Rogan because his answer was to vote and control elections. So they were trying to piss off their own voters. that we're now into Trump maybe with people who can't vote. And Stavros said like, yeah, my dad's immigrant, he can't vote. And Joe Rogan's like, well, they were thinking about it. And there actually isn't movement on that at all in Chicago. There is in other places like San Francisco, for instance, is looking at maybe letting people vote in school board elections because children of undocumented people go to school. And they should. Mm-hmm. And actually, that is something that even Republican presidents used to affirm in like the 90s. And it's a sign of like a fascist turn in this country that we have moved away from that. And in part because the Democrats are just as willing with Republicans to prefer the killing of immigrants in the Rio Grande River to the prosecution of bosses. Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, and as we've seen, I mean, you know, one of the notable things has been the continuation of Trump border policies under Biden, which is a much bleaker picture, by the way, than Trump's argument that there are just pure open borders. But just sort of walking through this gallery, I mean, another kind of classic version of this is something from Ted Cruz, a senator from the state of Texas, who tweeted this out and has been saying things like this forever. December 15th, illegal aliens should not be able to vote in federal elections, period. This should not be controversial. And again, just being very clear, and I'm sure everybody out there, you know, listening to this knows this, you cannot vote in the United States federal elections if you're not a citizen of the United States. It is not a thing that happens. Across the board in this country, there are all sorts of nets and attempts to make sure that people who are voting are actually registered and legal voters. And the Brennan Center, for example, in 2017, examined 42 local jurisdictions around the country in the 2016 election, including some of the most populous counties in Arizona, California, Florida, and Texas. Of 23.5 million votes cast, election officials only found about 30 cases of potential non-citizen voting that they referred for prosecution or further investigation. And as is important to note, and just really quick for folks, that is from ABC News. Trump suggests unauthorized migrants will vote. The idea stirs his base, but ignores reality. But as is noted here and is noted all across, you know, any kind of journalistic outfit worth their salt, is that the penalties for illegal voting in this country, especially for non-citizen, are stark, including fines, prison times, and deportation. You know, so the idea that, you know, there's just all these people just like, you know, shrugging their shoulders and voting, one is just, it's not something that has been proven. And it's something that most people understand the threat of.
Exactly.
So they don't, you know, no one even tries. You know, another one just from the ABC piece, a Georgia audit of its voter rolls in 2022. This is Georgia, right? A Georgia audit of its voter rolls in 2022 found fewer than 2,000 instances of non-citizens attempting to register to vote for 25 years. None of which succeeded. Millions of new Georgia residents millions of new Georgia voters registered during that period. Look, and at a certain time, it's almost a little dweeby to sit around here and like fact check these guys because it's an emotional plea, right? It's not something that is based in reality. It's trying to invoke this sense that America is changing and it's under threat. And actually, you're not just sort of out of step with the times and maybe changing demographics or changing populations in this country, but actually there is some kind of nasty secret plot by the government.
Right.
Ted Cruz will respond to when people say, hey, Ted Cruz, there's no proof that there has been any kind of, you know, any examples of serious coordinated voting by migrants, undocumented migrants in this country. Ted Cruz will then note that, well, there are cities in the United States that are allowing or are moving to allow or maybe have had referendums or ballot initiatives on the question about whether or not non-citizens should be able to vote. Places like D.C., in New York City, there were attempts to do this. I believe there was in Vermont, San Francisco, Oakland, and a couple other places, all with varying degrees of success. A lot of times, these attempts, by the way, are just blocked by courts. Other times, they are meddled with by the United States Congress, as sort of happened in D.C., where, you know, there were attempts because all of the laws in D.C. are reviewed by Congress because D.C. residents do not have the same rights as other Americans. You know, there were attempts by Congress to sort of limit their ability to make decisions about residents of D.C.'s ability to make decisions about who should be able to vote in school board kind of things. Anyways, to get to the point here, the argument of Ted Cruz that like basically this there's an attempt to expand the voter rolls with people who are voting in certain contexts and not others so that maybe more and more people can slip through the cracks is, again, just completely unsubstantiated, as somebody like Ted Cruz should know. You know, so it's just it's a kind of way of playing politics. And Ted Cruz, I think, better than the rest of them. Because, you know, Ted Cruz plays a dumbass on TV. That's like what his thing is. But the guy's, look, he's a nasty guy, but he knows what's going on. He reads. He understands things. When he makes these kind of arguments, he is trying to sort of target lowest common denominator folks, people who aren't really going to investigate too much, are going to hear somebody like Ted Cruz say, like, well, actually, there is a controversy around this. No matter how ridiculous or nonsensical or unsubstantiated, that is the kind of thing that gives legitimacy to Donald Trump's just sort of missives. And you know, that's the more sophisticated version there. Go ahead, Matt.
No, I think that you're exactly right to say that this is all by even like engaging in the conversation, you're granting a premise that this is a real problem and not just a hysterical plank of a campaign for presidency, which has existed since Trump lost and didn't accept that he lost and needed an excuse for why he lost. And it was because there's all, and what's terrifying to me kind of actually is I've been listening to some other sort of like comedy type podcasts, some in the UK, of people who they're not Trump supporters, but they'll even say things like, look, I think there might have been some fuckery against Trump, but not enough to have cost him the election. And it's like there might be instances of people voting they shouldn't have. When you actually look at those instances, often they're Republicans. But here's the thing is like on a structural level, it's fucking ludicrous to point to that as if it's any sort of like anything else than what it is when Bolsonaro does it in Brazil, which is an excuse to throw discredit elections that you might lose. And people need to, understand it as that.
And fundamentally, that's like the issue here is because, you know, the Republicans have been, you know, attempting to, you know, restrict the right to vote in this country for a long time. And they do it because they don't want certain groups of people to vote. American citizens. They don't want American citizens across the board, certain populations of American citizens to be voting. So they make it more difficult. So more and more people fall through the cracks, right? And they need two things. They need an excuse for why they're doing that, other than just sort of like, hey, we would like it to be more difficult for these groups of people to vote. And the argument has always sort of been like, well, shouldn't it be secure, the right to vote? Instead of actually looking at like the mass disenfranchisement of American citizens that happens when they sort of push these more punitive voter registration, voter ID laws.
Yeah. And there's like this thing of, if that's such a foolproof strategy, granted that like they can't vote. But if it's such a foolproof strategy, maybe Republicans should join the arms race and let some migrants in themselves who will then like vote for them. Maybe like a party turning against any sort of immigrant to a country is a disgusting thing for that party to do, especially in a country where, like, Trump could say like our border is crumbling. Our border has never done what anybody in government seems to think it, whether it's Joe Biden or Republicans. Like, that is a fucking permeable thing. We've never stopped traffic across that from people. We need to protect labor rights for those people and human rights for people that cross it. And we need to stop compelling people to be refugees in the first place, which is like, mm-hmm. maybe let's not destroy Venezuela's oil economy, for instance, or maybe let's do some reparation for that so people can stay there. God forbid, but that would be working with a communist, mm-hmm. right? Like, so it's wild how we don't have that conversation, because there is, despite how hysterical Stephen Miller might get about how Joe Biden is, you know, undermining the country, they're fundamentally closer on this than they like to let on.
No, and I think that's the thing that's really, really dangerous here, is that because as the right continues to try to push these things, a lot of people in the American public sort of think it's like, well, Joe Biden has been pursuing these certain kinds of policies that are the exact opposite of the Republicans. But no, Biden has actually worked with heroic effort to actually maintain and make permanent a lot of the policies of the Donald Trump administration, which is another reason why a lot of this kind of, why American politics can feel so bleak. This went a little bit longer than intended, so I did just want to jump to this really fast on our kind of gallery of nasty motherfuckers to another guy who, look, everybody who watches this program knows, Matt and I don't like this guy, Elon Musk. But his recent kind of fixation with the border is just extremely disgusting to me. One, because of, you know, what it is that he's advocating, but two, as a personal thing, nothing infuriates me more than when people come to Texas and then they start getting real, like, you know, to be Republican freaks and get really worked up about the border. Not to mention somebody who is an immigrant themselves to this country. Now, Musk has gone to the border and taken very disgusting photographs of himself, basically using migrants as props. But this, again, goes to something that I think is fundamental about Elon Musk, is the way that he has sort of bolstered some of the dumbest motherfuckers out there. And I don't think it's a small coincidence that these are people who pay him money. This is something where this guy, for whatever reason, now has, well, we know why, but like, this guy now has significant influence in like what Americans are seeing on their phones, at least. And he is just inundating people with just nasty, stupid propaganda. And oftentimes things that are just flat out fucking false, even in the context of what is being shown to you on the screen. Like, you don't even need to do a deep dive. You just do the reading instead of what's being shown to you on the screen. This is a recent one from Elon Musk, who goes, Arizona clearly states that no proof of citizenship is required for federal elections. And I was saying to Matt before we get into this, and we'll look at this in just a second, if Elon Musk wants to play this role that he's trying to play here of, you know, being a new kind of, you know, poster boy of the right wing, he needs to learn the landscape a little bit, right? Because Arizona is not a state that you look at for woke border policy and woke voting rights policy. In fact, what he is talking about here, and we can look at it really quickly, the reason that Arizona has the stipulation in its voter registration system is because the voting restrictions that have been put in place in Arizona are so out of step with federal policy and federal guidance on what is needed that they have to actually stipulate a separate system, a bifurcated system, to be able to vote in Arizona state elections exactly. and in federal ones. But we can look at this really crazy.
Basically, like, hey, like, we'd like to do poll taxes, but we get in trouble for doing that. So if you object to our poll tax, we'll give you a federal only ballot one. Yeah, that's
I think that's a very quick and easy way to look at it. I mean, just so no one watching thinks we're being tricksters or anything like that. It's not going to let me zoom in too much, but the highlighted portion here is: if you do not submit proof of citizenship, and we cannot acquire your proof of citizenship from the Arizona Motor Vehicle,
AKA division, sorry, David, but AKA the extra onerous step that puts too much onto people who want to vote that we want to do here.
Which has only federal races and no state, county, or local races or initiatives. Anyway, it's very clear if you do a little bit of research, or even if you know anything about politics in this fucking country. And this is the reason that, like, not only is Musk kind of dangerous because of, like, what he is advocating for, but he's also dangerous because we're watching a stupid guy with a lot of personal confidence sort of, like, sleepwalking through, like, political education, learning about American history, learning about American politics, and is bolstering some of the – I mean, the guy, no surprise there that Elon Musk was retweeting there, is a Bitcoin guy. No surprise that that person doesn't have very strong reading fundamentals. And if anybody has ever, it's like, oh, well, I'm not even going to argue for or against the Arizona laws here, right? But this context that they're talking about, have you ever voted in an election, Matt, where for whatever reason, maybe you had moved recently, when you showed up at your polling place – right? They didn't have your ballot. So you might have cast what's called a provisional ballot. And a lot of places you will do that. If you go there and you say, I have a right to vote, I'm going to vote, you're not going to turn me away, they will give you a provisional ballot. And if you get a provisional ballot, then it will be checked to see if it's valid later. It's not the same system there, but I'm just saying for anybody who's like confused as to why, this kind of system is because, why you would have a system like this in the first place. It's because, when you run a big bureaucracy, sometimes things get mixed up, right? Either on the state side or on the voter side. None of this, anyways, that's just basic fucking understanding about how voting in America and in democracy works in the first place. The other thing that's just, it's exceptionally clear, is none of this is saying in the thing that Elon Musk is retweeting there, in the actual facts of the law in Arizona, none of this is saying that Arizona is now basically allowing for illegal migrants or undocumented citizens, undocumented migrants to be voting in the United States. No, this is Arizona having to comply with federal policy, which, by the way, and there's a whole other can of worms we could talk about another day. It's ridiculous that we even let states administer elections at this point instead of the federal government. It's one of the most unique things about America. It's a disaster every time. All this freak out about fucking machines and all this kind of stuff. No, the fact that we have a patchwork system here with no kind of clear rules from state to state, that's a disaster. And it's not a disaster because, again, people are casting illegal votes. It's a disaster because it's too difficult for Americans to vote. Because if you were an American citizen, I think that you should be able to vote, and it should be something that is easy and accessible for you to do. And that's not going to happen as long as we let states run that system.
And you shouldn't need to go get a fucking driver's license first and go do this or that. You should be able to fucking vote. It's ridiculous. And the idea, and even granting the idea that, well, what about, that's not a problem. It's not a problem that our elections are influenced by a foreign voter base. And it's just hysterical, and it's borderline, like, it's like the first step on the yellow brick road of like replacement theory type hysteria. And I just think it's ludicrous how much even Democrats play into this. Oh, we got to be sensible. We got to do this or that. John Fetterman now making a name of like, well, I don't, despite my wife being an immigrant, I now think we got to play ball with Republicans. It's mm-hmm. A bleak, it's bleak what politics does.
Yes, sir. Well, folks, we're going to go over to our conversation with Sudeep. Really, really interesting one, talking about the Asian American community and socialism. It was really fun sort of taking that deep dive with him. When we get back, we're going to talk about, Matt, have you heard about these German farmer protests?
Yeah, a bunch of German Kowalskis, I guess, are taking over the country or something.
We're going to talk about the German farmer protest a little bit after the interview here, giving folks a little bit of context and also sort of responding to the out of breath way that a lot of kind of international events get covered on social media by weird right-wing TikTok influencers and things like that. So you won't want to miss it. So enjoy the interview, come back for that, and then join us in the postgame, patreon.com/leftreckoning, where we're going to be doing another kind of deep dive into the deranged and strange. So you won't want to miss any of that. Stay tuned, folks. We'll be right back.
Welcome back, Left Reckoners. I'm Matt Leck. With me, as ever, David Griscom. Hello, David.
What's up, brother?
Not much. Joining us now is Sudeep Bhattacharya. He is a doctoral candidate from in political science at Rutgers University. He is also a writer, organizer. You can find his work at outlets like Protean Magazine, Black Agenda Report, Counterpunch, Reappropriate, The Aerogram, and Hard Crackers. Sudeep, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
And I also want to shout out Sudeep, whose coverage of the New Brunswick nurses strike was sort of prefigured our coverage of it. So great work there, Sudeep. And since then, we've wanted to talk to you about a number of things regarding class politics, Asian American politics. And on that front, Dave Rubin has said something kind of, I think... You know, Dave is on the cutting edge of reactionary politics, and there's an attempted realignment going on right now as I think both reactionaries and liberals spin their identitarian wheels a little bit. Here is our buddy Dave talking a little bit about Stefanik's Harvard University business and talking about the who's being discriminated against.
College campuses. So I think the investigation is going to uncover much, much more. This is just, you know, about the university president on top of the institution, but it's an institutional rot that we are addressing because these colleges get billions of taxpayer dollars. And I believe as we continue our congressional investigation that we will uncover what will be the greatest scandal in higher education because the Harvard Corporation members themselves are complicit in this cover-up of her plagiarism and, again, most importantly, their failure to protect Jewish students on campus.
All right. That's the right spirit. Again, you get a win and now you keep going. What's really going on at Harvard? How much discrimination against Jewish students, Asian students, white students have they been doing over the years? Did they get a whole bunch of professors who were not qualified, who were plagiarizing, and a whole bunch more, who had all sorts of awful ideas related to Marxism and communism and wokeism and everything else? Did they all rise up the ranks while they took good professors out? Did all of those things happen? Probably.
So let's just maybe omit the plagiarism stuff out of this because they have a tough time kind of keeping focused on one issue here. But this, when Dave Rubin mentions Asian American discrimination against Asian Americans, let's like orient the conversation a little bit. Obviously, this is post affirmative action decision by SCOTUS. Like, what are the key contours we need to be thinking about, Sudeep?
Yeah, no, I mean, Dave Rubin is, there's a lot to unpack here because he just says a lot of stuff. And as you'll play later, he also says a lot of things about academia, which are very incorrect, about the sort of, you know, Marxists are being promoted left and right, which is, you know, hasn't happened for decades, actually. But yeah, one of the contours. So the affirmative action situation is really interesting because we know like Bakke v. California back in 78, already race was not necessarily, like racial quotas had ended in 78, but race was still one of the elements that could be used, which, and I mention that because how it's been formatted and framed by people like Rubin is it's as if none of that happened. That's one thing. Like we were just living in this weird space where if you're just a person of color, if you're black and brown, you just get in. That's not been the case since that time. And then the recent case, I believe it was about Harvard University and University of North Carolina being sort of attacked on the grounds of being discriminatory against Asians and white people, I guess. Yeah, I mean, that's also part of an old playbook, this idea of, because as much as Dave Rubin is an ideas man and not that bright, I think he knows just by saying white people are being hurt by this, I don't think would be enough. So that's why they drag in Asians. And this is, again, part of an old strategy. Like I mentioned, this brings to mind the model minority stereotype, which started officially in the 60s, and how that started is pretty indicative of how this sort of framing works. Back then, it was, I think, a white reporter who magically came across Japanese Americans who managed to stitch together their lives after in being incarcerated. And the framing of that was very similar. Like, the point of that was to say any critiques about the establishment made by Black folks especially aren't real, right? That,
right,
you know, this is the thing. It's not like they don't want Asians to be white. They need us to be people of color still, because then that sort of wins their argument. Like, these people of color have made it. They're the hardworking ones. That's all you need to do. So that's kind of like interesting to me, because again, Rubin, I don't know if he read this stuff, but I guess it speaks to just the saturation of these kind of ideas in the conservative sphere. Because again, he's not a bright guy. Like, I really do imagine him just rolling out of bed and just being like, looking at the mirror and saying, I'm enough, and then moving on. But it's just an old playbook.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. As you're talking, I'm one of the other, because Dave is really mailing it in now. He's got two kids. And so he's doing like short under 5 minute clips where it's just like him rolling something and then doing a short comment on it. He played a Thomas Sowell clip, and it was Thomas Sowell talking about why Jews are the most hated minority. And it was because they have the culture to, you know, acquire wealth and, you know, do good in society. And it's like, and you know, they have a culture that prioritizes learning and education, exactly what you're talking about with the mono minority.
And just to add really quickly to that, it's just that, I just want to also promote, there's a really awesome channel on YouTube, similar to yours, like in terms of what I gained from it. Like, it's called Black Power Media. And there's a really great media studies person, I think, Jared Ball. He talks about this too. Like, you also see some of that argumentation among pro-business types in the Black community who say, like, we need to also do what, quote unquote, Jews have done or white people have done, which is like own our businesses and such. But it's all a fabrication. Like, white people, those who did succeed, had government help. So that's another thing to keep in mind. Like, there's no magic cultural argument here. This is all part of the New Deal process and the Great Society, you know. So that's also an important thing to keep in mind. That too is a myth. Like, for Jewish Americans who've made it, it's not because of these weird, asinine, and fairly anti-Semitic views that there's something inherent in them which erases the struggles they've had. It's really about government programs. And now we're seeing groups not have that, so that's why they're kind of stuck or falling behind. So that's another thing to kind of add to this sort of milieu that Dave knows very little about.
Yeah, I mean, so much of that is based on, it is mythology, and it, like you said, like, the actual status of the law is pretty immaterial. It's what purpose does it serve in the wider discourse about, you know, why certain people are empowered and certain others aren't. Were you going to say something, David?
Well, I mean, I was just going to say that, like, you can almost trick yourself into, you know, falling into the trap that the right is setting here, because they can't even keep this settled down enough. You know, they just sort of talk about, you know, academia and Harvard and stuff. I mean, the new thing this week has been with that United Airlines is hiring too many Black pilots effectively, you know, and just like, you know, getting unqualified people to fly planes to meet DEI quotas, you know, and it's nonsensical. But, you know, this is a big part of, like, you know, the Harvard story for them, the reason that they're jumping on this is one, you know, for kind of just typical right-wing theatrics, but two, it is to try to make this really nasty and almost like retro, how explicit it is, racist point that there are like certain people who shouldn't be in positions of power. And if you do see somebody who's in a position of power, they probably got there because of, you know, some government program or somebody took pity on them rather than merit, you know. And it's extremely, extremely nasty. And you could just see that how quickly they move from just, you know, the Harvard case into all of these other things too.
How do you think, you know, I think we can understand how Dave Rubin thinks of Asian American, and, you know, 7% of the population here in America. How should, like, socialists think about the Asian American population? And, you know, like, what are, and yeah, before we get to the, I guess, the campaign politics of it all with Trump and maybe the liberal response.
No, that's, I mean, So this is coming from some of the research I've done. Like, I typically work around issues of the potential and the potentialities and obstacles towards building coalitions among people of color. Because the other thing is that in social science, it's gone better, frankly, when it comes to disentangling how we should talk about race in some effect. Like, usually white and non-white for a long time, which is really ridiculous, because within that non-white circle of things, there's a lot of things to unpack. So that's what I focus on. But, you know, through that, I've also been focusing on Asian American politics for a couple of reasons. One, as an Asian American who grew up in Central Jersey, you know, I've seen the gamut of Asian American politics. Like, where I grew up is a suburb, you know, set of suburbs, but they're not lily white, leave it to beaver suburbs either. And which is, you know, happening across the country. It's an area where you see poverty still. You also see so-called Asian American success stories, like entrepreneurs. There's an entire area where I used to grow up and used to live where, you know, it's entire avenues that are kind of like the Desi Mecca, the South Asian Mecca. So you see a whole gamut of that. And my own family is like very mixed. Like, I have family members who are very white collar. And I also have family members who've worked in different kind of other businesses as cashiers. So it's all of that. So I guess for me, as a socialist, one thing to do is not to look at Asian Americans as so unique, right? I think that's the first thing to do. Like, because there could be a tendency to do that, understandably, sometimes, like, where there's not a lot of information if you're not someone living in the areas I've been. But that's the number one thing. Don't do that. And it's also not just for white socialists, or, you know, like, I teach classes on Asian American politics, and that's something I also stress to my majority Asian American students. Like, number one thing is that, you know, I don't mean to like be so self-deprecating, like we're not special, but we're not, like, in that sense. Like, the stuff that affects the rest of America affects us. That's number one. And number two, if you dig deeper, how Asian Americans have been spoken about by the conservatives really is very outdated, like extremely so. I mean, it's always been the case that most Asians are not wealthy, like, you know, diaspora wise, it's just not possible and it's not true, you know. But even more recently within America, inequality has become more pronounced. New York City, for example, I think one out of every four Asian Americans, there was a 2020 report, I'm pretty sure it got worse since then, that says live in poverty. Again, it's not like the percentage who has the highest number in poverty is Asians, but of course African Americans, Latinx are just behind them. But that's another thing, like the major areas of the country, Asian American populations are pretty large. So they live in areas that are, cost of living is really high. You know, again, what we see in cities, gentrification happening. So income inequality is a huge thing. So that's another thing to think about. And then thirdly, for socialists, you know, class struggle still matters then. Like, you know, it's not to argue that Asian Americans are like there. You know, I'm not saying that either. Like I said, where I grew up, it's one of the reasons why I'm a socialist, but I've seen many Asian American community leaders kind of like maneuver class in a different way, you know, whether it be the Democratic Party or occasionally Republican. I mean, most people here are Democrats, but they're like Biden-esque Democrats. So yeah, like not to give up on Asian Americans and not view them as this sort of, not to fall prey to those conservative ideas that as people of color, we're somehow that different. Like there's a lot of growing need and frustration among Asian Americans. And finally, like even if you look at Center for American Progress, again, these reports are fairly old and I'm assuming they're worse, but it's one of the reports I use for my own work. The biggest gap between income. So there's a report that says the gap between Asian Americans who earn the most and Asian Americans who earn the least is the highest than any other racial and ethnic group. And again, this is all material stuff, right? This is the ways of immigration are different. Family reunification plays a part. So like I said, my family is mixed. So, you know, my family's like family who we, you know, sponsor to come here. Not everyone has the same, they have degrees, but they're not the same level of jobs. And also the economy is different. Like there's a writer I like, Professor Sanjay Mishra. He says this, like a lot of Bangladeshis who did come to the United States, they came during the 1990s. It's a very different material landscape to enter into, regardless of degrees. I mean, this is why you take like a taxi or you see gas station operators, like they're educated, but they came during the worst period of Clintonite, Reaganite aftermath of neoliberalization. So that's another thing, again, back to the number one point, we're not that special. We're affected by, impacted by very similar things that other groups of people are.
Yeah, I mean, and class seems to be like the one thing that both liberal and reactionaries, as they, you know, as liberals freak out about certain margins getting slimmer that they depend on, and you know, Republicans sort of, you know, seeking that as a, you know, the maybe easier than it's fascinating how that sort of the class blindness of it is so pronounced. I mean, maybe you'll get some Republican. No, it's pretty much both both sides are going to be class blind to it.
Well, really quickly, even after the shooting death of, I think, 7 women or 8 women, but most of whom were Asian American in Atlanta, I remember reading some, because I wrote something, or maybe I was planning to write something, but there was like a quick Google search about how some people were interpreting the tragedy. And there was this sort of like, again, this kind of push to buy Asian American small business kind of stuff. And even the Biden administration, I think in 2020, they mentioned a task force, which is good, but part of that was against small business stuff. And it did mention Asian American workers, to be honest, but, you know, to treat both of these things as similar or same. And I remember reading a New York Times profile piece about, I think, the kids of one of the victims who died, who was murdered. And they, I think, if I remember correctly, and I think I wrote this somewhere, they said that their mom hated their job, you know? And I remember that sticking to me because I was like, this story gets either submerged or it gets thrown away. At the end of the day, again, they were murdered, but even the bigger picture is even, you know, still troubling. Like, even if they weren't attacked, the situation they were in was not great. Like, they literally said, or they said something to the effect that they barely saw her, they barely got a chance to really spend time with her, and she didn't like her work. So I think that stuck with me too. And you're right, I think the class analysis, if it's even mentioned, it's kind of like a throwaway, or it's like, I don't know, it's not substantive. It doesn't really speak to a lot of the interesting potentials that there could be, you know, for people to organize.
I mean, that's grim, that the best thing our political class can do is come together to support businesses, which, you know, certain businesses are under attack, they should be supported. But like, when the people hated their job, I mean, man, yeah, that's a grim detail. Let's talk a little bit about, do you have any sort of, the elections get a lot of attention, and they're really a crucible through which a lot of people view politics, in terms of, like, I've seen the numbers, a lot more people pay attention when there's two different presidents, candidates running against each other. How do you view this stuff going on? You know, just right before we're speaking, we had protesters interrupt Joe Biden in Charleston at the church that Dylann Roof massacred people at. And you have people saying, how dare you, interrupt Joe Biden there. And I'd just say, you know, any place Joe Biden is, he should hear about what he's doing in Gaza. And you should not disgrace any place by using it as a shield for that politician. But yeah, I'm curious what you think about the upcoming election and what we might hear about different racial appeals.
Yeah, it's complicated. I would be wrong if I said I knew everything, because we're entering, I mean, literally, I never thought there'd be a pandemic. Never thought we'd actually be worse off around Medicare for All after the pandemic.
Yeah.
Never thought that we'd have a George Floyd uprising after the murder of George Floyd and it being sort of a drop in the bucket. Like, that was, you know, a big thing. So there's a lot of things, I have to be honest, I don't know where it's gonna go. Like, even if you look at the numbers, it's all over the place. Like, you have, so again, as someone who, I teach classes on Asian American and Marxism and all these different things. All I can say, just broadly speaking, a lot of my students were either upset or just confused by Palestine, by the level of insincerity with Biden and how he's tackling this issue, while with Ukraine and other situations, it was like, you know, we're on the cusp of ending democracy and we need to fight. So that was a little surprising, right, for me even. And then in that sense, it wasn't like everybody, so I don't know, because there's so many other concerns. And also, I just want to add, it's really, I saw a clip right before the show where the people in the audience were also cheering 4 more years eventually as the protesters were being escorted. So that's also surprising. Like, it's just a wacky time, to be honest. Like, I don't really know what's going on. All I can say with the different racial appeals, I think with Trump, like, I looked up some of the numbers for Latinx, again, registered voters, because there's so many people who are unregistered. There's been like a big shift, right? Like, literally Biden was kind of leading 61 to 35, and now it's like 48, 43 or 48, 45. So that's a huge and I don't think that's going to change really for Biden, because what else? I mean, if it's not Palestine, it must be something else, which is, of course, the border policies and other issues like jobs. With Asian Americans, I think the number has stayed around 35% and 36 because Trump, and again, this is something I've heard from my friends and from students, is that they remember Trump talking about COVID virus as China virus. They do remember that. And so that's something like, even with some of my conservative minded students who are, you know, changing over time or are still like relatively moderate on some things, they remember that. They're just like, that was crazy. Like, I didn't. And for them, that was the first time of facing something so explicit. Because remember, they grew up under Obama, right? So this like racial, you know, rainbow coalition, more like, you know, with the center left and center right, it's like a rainbow coalition of like assholes. But at the same time, they developed an interest sort of in politics, but also a little bit of myopia. Like, they really thought it's just Obama, then Trump, and we're going to get back something normal. And a lot of them were interested in Biden. Like, I remember teaching during the presidential, a lot of students were upset about those 4 days where things were like hanging in the balance, and they were really upset. They were like, I really want Biden to win. And I didn't blame them, because that's all they were. But now I'm seeing like a more complicated feeling. Like, a lot of them are upset about the choices, period. But then a lot of them remember what Trump said. So I don't know. And then as for like, the only thing I can say for sure, I don't think this, there's going to be a huge bump among African-American registered voters for Trump. I don't think that's ever going to happen.
For and Trump,
Yeah, I don't think, I think that's a bit of a stretch. When people say that, like even when Trump said that thing about Nikki Haley recently, where he was attacking her for not saying, I kind of like, it was really, because he was so sarcastic. Like, oh, slavery, I heard, was a core, you know, you kind of think it was a real issue. So I was like, all right. Like, and then he said something to the effect of like, would have been better for her to say that rather than three paragraphs of BS, basically, he said. I think you mentioned this on Majority Report with someone. It's not for black voters. That's really for white voters and other non-white groups who can then say to their friends, I'm not being racist, and making them feel comfortable to vote for Trump. Right.
Right. I mean, it's also, I think, too, in fairness with Trump, it's just like, if he's got something he can, if he can put a knife in somebody's back, he's just going to do it. And it doesn't need to be coherent with anything else in his project, you know? No, I mean, on that, I wanted to sort of ask you, you know, a question about this. And I know, like, it's difficult to talk about, you know, groups at large, because I find, you know, especially I feel like with Asian American voters, you know, region plays a big part. Obviously, origin also plays a big role in all this kind of stuff. But I'm curious, you know, what your perspective is on, you know, the GOP being able to start to, you know, expand support. Because, you know, I remember somebody saying something that I found to be a little silly when Vivek Ramaswamy, you know, first sort of came on the scene, and people were like, oh, well, like an Indian guy, like people in the South will never vote for that. It's like, well, you know, Bobby Jindal, Nikki Haley, like, you know, there's actually like a lot of like South Asian figures in the Republican Party in the South. And, you know, the point is not that the South, the GOP in the South is like, you know, racially tolerant or anything like that. Just the GOP, I think, has been actually a lot more flexible than I think a lot of liberals give them credit for. On, you know, we'll put on women and people of color run for office, of course. You know, and I think that's been, you know, here in Texas, you're seeing, you know, the GOP continue to pick up support across minority groups, you know, across the board. Still, the Democrats still dominate, but look, they're making inroads, and that's bad. If you want to see Democrats win, anyway, I'm just sort of curious if you have any thoughts on, you know, the Republicans being able to appeal, you know, increase their share around Asian American voters, and also, you know, if there are any kind of, you know, serious missed opportunities with the Democrats in the same way with Black and Hispanic voters, how they sort of like, oh, these people always line up and support us under, you know, whatever we do, whatever conditions.
No, I mean, I think you mentioned Texas, and I mean, Beto O'Rourke is hella annoying, but one of the reasons why he didn't win, I think, in the last chance was because of Asian voters. Again, it wasn't overwhelmingly GOP, but it was just enough to carry Abbott forward. And also in Florida and other parts of the South, there's like, they're not overwhelmingly supporting Republicans.
I mean, just to be fair, I mean, like, Beto lost by like 12 points.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm not, but still at the same time, if you just, it's important to see the numbers and not to assume that all people of color are just lining up so easily. And if you look at other sections, he wasn't as high as Texas when it comes to Republican votes, but there's like, again, similarly at the national scale, 30%, which is significant, right? That's what I mean. Like, it's a really big but so also the Vivek, I think the one caveat that's different about him, and I mean, who cares? But like, he, like with Nikki Haley, and one of the things I learned about Bobby Jindal, like, you know, his real name is Piyush, it's Bobby. Mm-hmm. Same with Nimrata. Like, they both converted to Christianity. I remember, again, the main things to remember about South Asian enclaves, like a lot of us live in Jersey, live in New York City. I remember having conversations back then. And I just want to also preface, like, my family is liberal to left, and they're Bengali American, so they come, you know, my grandfather was a CPIM member. So it's not like, I'm just letting people know that when I'm coming forward, I'm not just like speaking for everyone. Like my parents, like my dad would talk about Lenin. He's amazing. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, great. So when Bobby Jindal comes through, I'm like, who's this guy? But all that to say, even with my friends who are normies and liberals, they were like never into him, really. They were just, this is strange. Why is his name Bobby? Like, we have Christian Indians. I'm not belittling that, but even Christian Indians are like, what is this? So that's one thing I think Vivek Ramaswamy is different on. Like, I think he's Hindu, but he also doesn't do anything that suggests that. Like, he's rapping songs badly. He's rhyming campaign trail with trail. Like, he's just a corny Republican guy, right? Like, he's like, there's nothing special about him. So that's the only caveat I would add. But even in New Jersey, I remember in 2016, there was a really well-to-do financier. I think it was called the Republican Hindu something association. And he invited Trump to a convention in Edison. And I bring that up because I think it was a good encapsulation of some of these things. Like, so my thing is, I don't think you're going to see, like, again, Indian Americans flocking to Vivek or flocking to right-wing politics here. Another reason for that is the 9/11 experience. When I talk to people, that was a huge deal. And it's still a lot of things to be unpacked about it. A lot of things. Like, it was intense. If you're living in Jersey and New York City, I remember growing up as a kid, like I was 11 or 12, we were talking about, like my uncle had to return from the bus stop, let's say. Like, it was intense and it was unrelenting. People's responses to it were different. People put American flags, some people donated to politicians and things of that nature, but it really made a huge difference. And it's one of the reasons why you saw a lot of South Asians, Indian Americans, especially going towards Obama too. Like, it was a huge shift in that sense. So I don't think that's going to go away. Like, whatever, however Vivek raps, whatever, you know, says, and whatever Nikki Haley says about Israel, it's not going to make a difference, right? But the one thing I do worry about is a section of South Asians, just like with African Americans, being sort of feeling like they don't have a choice, and that's like the older crowd. You know, I've also spoken to older Indian Americans. My parents, too, they like Bernie. They have liked him. And now he's not really in the picture anymore. But even when he was, they were like, are you sure he's going to win? Those kind of issues came up. And Trump is just terrible. And then so they're just kind of like backing off from these real political horizons. And again, within the Indian American community and South Asian community, you have these community leaders and community groups that are not really about building an actual left. Right. Like, that's so whatever frustrations there might be, you're being told by the Indian American politically aligned person to hold that back and just, you know, go to your temple, go to your mosque, donate, and then focus on just winning the Democrats again. And in a state like New Jersey, it's become like a mess. Like, Menendez is in trouble. Like, Cory Booker is talking about love and peace all the time and nonsense. Like, nonstop. But one thing they did, I have to add, like, you have some South Asians in the party, and I remember that Phil Murphy took them on a trip to India too. So that's the goal. And that's only happening because there isn't a real force to take people's actual concerns and say, no, it can be developed into something much more substantive than just making trade deals with India. And also it's offensive. Like, these both of them, I think, are born and raised in the United States. Or I'm just like, why are you also assuming these two Indian American guys, or you could talk like a language, whatever, like, I don't even know what region their parents are from originally. So, like, you know, who are they? But they're playing that role. And that's my point. It's not so much like, I just think that the Democratic leadership is also right-wing itself and center-right. So whatever right-wing aspirations there might be, like, say, a business owner, they're not going to vote GOP at the national level if they're Asian American, because it's just, you know, it's crazy. But they can still get what they want within the Biden-esque sort of wing of the Democratic Party. And that's my worry. It's not so much they're going to run to the extreme right so much, even though some have. I think they're just going to be the stable force to form this weird Biden coalition of some kind of good trade union policies and also like poor business policies.
Yeah, you know, I'm curious, you mentioned that the 9/11 experience, and I'm curious, like the especially for like younger South Asian Americans, like is that the dominant sort of context to see what's going on in Gaza right now and the effect that might have on attitudes toward Biden?
Maybe. I'm not really sure. Like, I'm not that. I'm like 35. With my friends, they are. Like, and right. I think, I guess with my group, it would matter because we grew up consciously of 9/11, like being 12 years old, like it's really stuck to you. And I do talk to my friends who are South Asian, both Hindu, Muslim, and Christian. Of course, again, all of them are either liberal to left, but it is a big thing. Like it's definitely something where I've seen my friends respond in ways that are not like totally surprising, but kind of are. I have friends who are constantly sending me tweets about like what Biden said. And say, and literally ask, because I'm the political scientist person, even though I don't know a lot.
Right.
He's just like, what do you think's going to happen? Like, what should we do? And I'm just like, I don't know, actually. Like, I think it sucks. Like, I don't know what to say. But that's been a thing. And I know for my parents, too, like, again, they're part of the CPIM. They're not, like, they have a capacity to be radical, but they're not always the best in solidarity still. But even, I remember my dad watching the news recently on the BBC, or maybe it was Al Jazeera, and he was like, yeah, I'm not a fan of Hamas, but this seems excessive. Like when he was talking about the carpet bombing. And I, again, he's always been the guy to push me to be better, but I never heard that kind of stuff from him. Like Israel, Palestine, he does listen to me. And he's like, oh, a good dad. He's like, oh yeah, that really sucks. But I never heard him say it on his own, like just watching the news. And I didn't want to partake in it when I was visiting them because I was just like so depressed about it. And the last thing I want to do is like look at these images of kids. Like, I don't know, you know, like, I think Norman Finkelstein mentioned in another interview, like, kids are now having, I don't know if this is, he mentioned this, but, like, kids are so stressed out, they're having, like, heart attacks, from the stress. So, I don't want to, not saying I don't want to deal with it, but, like, every moment, but he brought it up. He was watching the news. He typically turns it off when it's really disturbing, and he was watching the news, and he said, like, this is a lot of people. And that was at 11,000. And now it's 12,000. And one thing I'll add, the 9/11 experience does make it easier for South Asian Americans to have a little bit of concern about like issues like BLM. I've seen that happen a little bit. But it's always like deviating. Because again, as a socialist, I crisis does not beget like, you know, revolution or anything. Like crisis can actually lead people to more crisis internally. They get confused, chaotic. Like there was a poll about African Americans who both wanted... They believed that reforms were necessary but would not happen, but they also wanted the funding for police to stay the same or increase. I think it was a year ago. And that could happen with everyone. Like if we don't have a socialist party really advocating for things and organizing people independently, whether they be white collar worker or blue, you're going to have people ending up being really weird, like having very weird politics. And that's like normal stuff. Like I've had conversations with people in my building where they say some progressive things and then they end up being like, I don't know, like taking it out on some other group. And I live in an area that is not white. Like it's like has a significant number of African Americans who are older, who've seen a lot and are kind of, to be honest, also stuck in a situation with this building and everything. Like, well, I don't understand why they're so upset about every small thing. You have also Asian Americans, Indian Americans who are working class in this building. So I'm hearing that from a whole swath of people of color. Like they're not Republicans yet. They talk to me about it. But still, when I tease out what they think, if I'm like really interested in doing something else like laundry, I'm like, oh, okay. Then it's like housing is important, for example, but then it just goes into a different place because who's engaging them? It's the Democratic Party. Who's not interested in taking it further than that?
Right. You had a very fascinating piece in Hard Crackers at hardcrackers.com, Socialism or Suburbia, Sadeep. Talk a little bit about that piece. Intro that for folks, because I thought that was fascinating. As somebody who, like, I'm from North Dakota, which is basically a town in North Dakota, so I'm like a suburb of no urban area. But I really liked that view, because I view that as one of the dominant, like me and people from more rural areas. Get into that a little bit for us.
Yeah, no, I mean, so I wrote that piece for a couple of reasons. One, it comes from a place of just actually organizing in New Jersey and realizing yes, it's safe, but it's also all these other places stemming from it. That's New Jersey, really. Like it's one big sprawl. That's really what it is. And then the other reason why I wrote about it, because it comes from some elements of my own other writing work and research, where you're seeing more people of color move into the suburbs. You're seeing, again, people of color who are becoming part of the middle class for a while since 1990s. But then, of course, low-wage work also becoming a reality. Like there's a lot of warehouses here. You know, they're pretty deep in New Jersey, so you have to live around the area. There's a ton of like warehouses, motels, et cetera, et cetera. So for me, it's like, to be a better organizer and thinker, you kind of have to disentangle this. And also just frankly speaking, I wanted to write something that I could sort of disentangle my own experiences, being someone who's downwardly mobile, has seen and experienced class in a different way, but also grew up in the suburbs, in like a middle income suburb. But yeah, I'm really glad you enjoyed it. Cause like, for me, it's really about also talking about race and class in a way I think is necessary. Like there is a, like to be really honest, sometimes I get really bored with conversations around race and class sometimes, because it's like everyone wants to find the correct theory to explain, like the Stuart Hall thing, like race or class is the way that race is lived and what, I don't know. But like everyone's really into finding the exact puzzle piece in. And sometimes I'm just, or they use terms like racial capitalism, which I used to use a lot before. But then I got bored with that a little bit. And so for me, I was like, why am I getting bored with these terms? Like, what's missing? So this was like another way of like doing that for myself. And the reason why I also wanted us to focus on the suburbs, because I do think it's also a place of potentiality. It's not just a place where you should write off. Like, you shouldn't look at a really white place. You shouldn't look at it as like just, you know, middle income folks who are, you know, really center right, which is true, not denying that. It's also a place where, again, I mean, I think the numbers have shown that 60% of the increase in poverty in the country, I don't know how long, maybe for in the last 10 years, has been in the suburbs. Still, the cities have a higher number, like around 12%, within the suburbs, like 9 to 10. But that's something, right? And again, it speaks to what's actually happening in the country. Like, again, when people say even like inner cities, when they say that stuff, I always get so suspicious of them. I'm like, are you living in like a 1980s Pierce Brosnan? When people say like inner city, so I get so weirded out. I'm like, what are you talking about? The inner city is literally the place where you see a Whole Foods or something. Like it's completely, and you can't organize well if you don't talk to reality. So to me, writing this piece was just one attempt at like having a piece out there that I can share with people and say like, these are some things that I think we really need to think about that are kind of missing from the discourse so far.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I talk to certain people from home and they're like, how do you even survive in New York City? It's like, New York has less violent crime than Omaha, like per 100. Like people don't understand a lot of these things. Sadiq, are you a Sixers fan?
I feel my partner is a Sixers fan. I watch them, but I'm more of a Knicks fan. But I do watch them. Yeah. I just feel, because I'm now in the Philly area, so I feel conflicted because I've seen a game and stuff. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to get that disclosure up front because you have good coverage of the Sixers are looking to put a new arena in Philly in Chinatown and downtown there. Right now their arena is probably down with all like the football field and baseball stuff. Just to talk a little bit, because that's another one where rather than getting theoretical about these discussions of race and class, you have like actual communities and capitalism and how it's actually going to interact.
So that piece was really important to me because even though I still view myself as fairly new in the area, it's only been like 3 years I've lived there. I've lived here since COVID. I just know that the Sixers are trying to move their arena, which is, like you said, kind of in the city but outside the city, in an okay spot, actually. It makes sense to me, but they always want to be where the businesses are. They're trying to move it, and it's supposed to be like to make it better, privately funded. You know, so they're saying like, we're not going to take any added government largesse, which is not, you know, who knows? Like, they're obviously will. But
yeah, no eminent domain, no none of that. Like,
right, we'll laws to protect private property. It's just going to be, you know, heart and soul, just a good-hearted attempt to bring attention to Chinatown. So there's three billionaires involved in this. One of whom is associated with Blackwater, something like another, not exactly Blackwater, but it has to do with housing situations, and then another person who is in property development. Either way, they want to move the Sixers Stadium basically into Chinatown. And a lot of people in Chinatown don't want it. And this isn't the first time that the city's trying to impose a big structure there. They tried to have a casino and the people there didn't want it. They did have a highway that split the community, which they didn't want. And they also tried to put a prison there. And I think the Philadelphia Phillies wanted to move their stadium there too. And they also didn't want it. So that's been the reoccurring issue for them. And I mentioned it because I think the current mayor, the one who just got inaugurated, Cheryl Parker. And this is what I mean by Biden-esque politics, because she is kind of good on labor issues. It's one of the things that actually won her election against even some more progressive people, because she had the endorsement of certain construction trade unions. But she promoted in her own way the Sixers Stadium as a way for jobs to come through. Right. So, and also the one of the owners, again, this also speaks to how people, how certain people think about people of color. So he did also say that businesses in the stadium, in this new stadium, I think at least 30% could be higher, would be set aside for African-American business owners. And there was a ton of African-American like opposition to this leadership who's like, we don't want anything to do with this. And you're pitting us against Asian-Americans. Like, this is also Chinatown. What that means. I think he literally just didn't care. He's just like, oh, person of color, person of color. So it's going to be awesome.
You know, I mean, I've been to, I had a friend who lived in Chinatown. And I'm like, that can't, that's not that big of a place. And I mean, I'm looking at a map and it's even smaller than I would have guessed based on the fact that people want to cram a basketball stadium in there. Like, there, I don't know how much, like the convention center is like a fourth of the size of Chinatown already. I don't know.
And that displaced people. That displaced people already. I think it was a 1990 or something. And then one thing I wrote in the article is that some of the activists did take a trip to D.C. because the Asian American community had already faced this issue and kind of lost, unfortunately, for now. And I used to live in D.C. and I know what they're talking about. Like, I've been to the Chinatown there. It was
I was going to say the same thing, because there are basketball stadiums right there in Chinatown. And that Chinatown, they have Fuddruckers and, you know, Applebee's, but it's got, you know, Chinese characters, Chinese characteristics are on it. You know, it's not really, you know, it's Chinatown. Really,
it's really a Chinatown block. Like, when I went there and was for a parade, I was really struck by that. Even though I only grew up in the suburbs, I'm originally from New York, and I remember Chinatown being so robust. And when I went there, I also had the same reaction where I saw, like, like they mentioned in the article, like a Walgreens with Chinese characters or language. And I was like, what is this? Like, how is this a thing? And then the older people who live there, again, to the idea of Asian Americans, like, these are working class, lower income enclaves of working class people. Chinatowns aren't gimmicks. They were created, you know, as a bulwark against, of course, white supremacist attacks, but as a self-sustaining economy to a degree, right? This again shows a limit of small business, right? It's important to have them, not denying them, but they have a severe limitation. Like, we need, what we need is actual housing as a right. What we need is no longer a society where private business is the distributor of major resources like housing and healthcare. But to that effect, the Chinatown there has been severely undercut. And now the older people there, they actually have to like take a bus to, like, I think Northern Virginia to get the basic groceries they once had there in their community, you know, and they're old. They're not going to be able to like live in other parts of DC anyway. So it's either they just stay there and take these bus rides every Saturday or Sunday, or they're also going to be forced out to know, I don't even know where.
Yeah. People should check that out. That piece is in progressive.org. Sudeep, where can people find your work?
Yeah, they could find my work at several outlets. Like you mentioned the Nurses one, that was at Jacobin, but that was also republished from Labor Notes. They can find a Protein magazine. If they want to follow me on Twitter, because I post things that I write there, it's Resist Run at Twitter. And then, you know, that's where they can kind of follow what I've been up to lately.
Did you update that at, or did I just never notice that was your at?
No, that's mine. That's been mine since a long time ago. I think the difference is it's only been the last 3 years I've really actually taken Twitter or X more seriously about promoting things, I think.
I see you there all the time. I don't know how that...
Yeah, I'm the same feeling too, man, but we should believe him.
I never updated it. It's the only name I have.
Well, we will include a link to at ResistRun so you can people follow you on Twitter. Sadeep, thank you so much, man. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you guys for having this conversation, and yeah, I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I did want to make sure we disclose that Sadeep is a Knicks fan.
Yeah, that was important.
Control for any bias in the reporting.
No, it was really great having him on the program. People should definitely check out his work. There are links below to do that and follow ResistRun. Even though Matt and I think that there's a big conspiracy about that at.
I'm having a Mandela effect with his Twitter at.
So I want to talk a little bit about the farmers' protest in Germany, Matt. But before we do that, I'm really liking this getup you got here, and I was just wondering, how could I find myself something like that—a nice tank top and a cool hat.
Both of these items are available at leftreckoning.com/store. Our hat here, which people, you know, just going, just selling gangbusters. And also this tank top, which I'm wearing, people might be a little bit confused because the weather in New York is pretty horrible today, but I got soaking wet on the way home. And this was at the top of my laundry. And I'm like, you probably aren't going to have a better opportunity over the next few weeks to wear the tank top than, you know, when it's promotional. And also you're underneath all the lights and monitors are up. So I do get a little bit warm doing the show. So it's nice to air out the pits a little bit. So, yeah, we also have on the other spectrum of things. Can I grab it?
We have our fence cutters hoodie.
Yeah,
which is our new item.
Warm.
Yeah, honestly, it's really nice.
It's very cozy.
And you get all that at leftreckoning.com/store. It really does help us out a lot. So please consider it. You know, it helps us. It helps keep the show going, and you get a pretty nice thing to wear around.
I think it looks pretty badass. I think, like, especially like the hat looks like something you could like roll into, like, you know, Sturgis.
I wear that. Sort of, wear that hat all the time.
Yeah,
I gotta say, I have to catch myself though now that I've been wearing the sweatshirt more, because I feel like for me, y'all should definitely do this. Y'all should get the tank top wear underneath the sweatshirt and the hat. But for me, like being the guy who runs the show, if somebody asks me in public, "Oh, what is that?" and I'm like, every article of clothing that I'm wearing is Left Reckoning branded merch. I feel a little silly about it, so I only do one at a time. But it's hard.
Yeah, it does feel it is a little bit like, I don't know, Matthew Lesko, that guy who always wore the suit around DC to say, this is how you can get money from government programs. Like, you got Left Reckoning. Although, you know, sometimes, like, I mean, it's so, you don't think about it because it's a nice, you know, hat.
That's what I'm saying. It's like, it's just good clothes.
Yeah. And then the sweater has been really clutch this winter.
Yeah. So leftreckoning.com/store. And obviously, if you want to support the show, get all the bonus episodes, you can do that at patreon.com/leftreckoning. But enough promotion. Before we get over to the post game, patreon.com/leftreckoning, let's talk a little bit about what's going on in Germany. And, you know, we did an episode pretty recently taking a deep dive into the German Greens, German kind of climate change policy, workers' policy. People should definitely check that out. That was out in December. So if people want like a good context about like what's going on when it comes to climate change politics in the country of Germany, definitely check out that episode. I'll put it in the show notes for folks. But we want to talk about this today we want to talk a little bit about what's going on in Germany. One, both to give people the context of what's going on, and two, to sort of talk about something that I think is really kind of dangerous in general, but is also very personally annoying, which is the way these kind of global events get covered on social media in particular, particularly TikTok and Twitter, now that Musk has been sort of boosting these guys. But before we get into maybe that more holistic conversation, let's just get a few things out of the way to set the stage for folks. First of all, as
as people who watch this program know, one of the big questions that we ask as socialists, as people who are pro-worker, about climate change policy is, who is going to be responsible for paying for the transition? Is it going to be major corporations that have polluted and decimated the planet, or is it going to be thrown on the backs of everyday folks? We've seen across the globe that the favorite principle of a lot of people in government has been normal folks pay for it. You saw this with attempts to raise prices of staple things, like diesel in France. You see these kind of attempts in the United States, Canada, all across the globe. There are these attempts to basically make consumer products more expensive for everyday people. And you start getting these kind of revolts. Now, we can go into the class nature of each one of these examples. We can talk about whether or not the right wing infiltrated. But there is a general tendency right now to sort of pit climate change between two forces. The populist right, which is fighting for cheap commodity goods for people, and the kind of PMC left, which is saying that we want to have higher taxes on folks, right? You can blow up that binary a bunch of different ways, and I think it's really important for the left to sort of refuse these kind of false parameters, because what you can do, and we should be advocating for, is to be advocating for a better life for everyday people, so that people are not cost burdens, so that people who work in certain industries do not find their prospects in life decimated and devastated by good green policy. And that we can do all of that, improve people's life, improve unionization, higher wages, better products, all that kind of stuff within a green framework. Now, unfortunately, that's not been the case in many countries. And in Germany, we are starting to see the backlash against that. So what is going on in Germany? You might have seen this. The right wing is all over it. There, if you go on Twitter, you can see people like Peter Sweden, all these white nationalist accounts celebrating this event, which, of course, clouds people's ability to analyze what's going on. There have been massive protests of German farmers and haulers in the country who are protesting against proposed increases in tolls, in the price of diesel, and the end of certain kind of subsidies for agricultural vehicles for farmers. Now, why has this come about? It's come about because Germany in particular is so wedded and so fearful of using debt that the Supreme Court of Germany ruled that the budget for the government in Germany was illegal, which has now led for the government in Germany to sort of scramble to make up costs. And a lot of those costs are going on everyday folks. In the case of these farmers, in the case of pulling back subsidies and increasing certain tolls for folks. Now, this is, I think, goes into like a fundamental kind of contradiction that we're having, is that we need to absolutely be shifting the way that we produce, the way that we consume energy, all this kind of stuff. But the question is going to be, what version of this is possible? In Germany, both because of the kind of political weakness of the left, but also because of the neoliberal consensus around a fear of using any form of deficit spending, a fear of going into debt by any metric. We're now seeing in Germany a very real example of what might come when you start trying to push certain green policies without doing the groundwork of making sure that these things are socially equitable. So that's a little bit of the context. There's been massive protests. People have seen them, tractors driving into cities, all sorts of kind of actions like that. There's been protests all over the country. Now, what's notable is that, and one of the things that is creating a lot of anxiety, is the fact that the far right is doing what the far right loves to do, which is they see people out there marching for something, and they're like, oh, these folks are marching for whatever the fuck it is that we're promoting. And there's been a serious attempt from the far right in Germany to try to, infiltrate, coalesce, and take over these kind of protests. And you saw the same kind of things, for example, in Canada, certainly similar things in France too. And in Germany is no different, especially in Germany, actually, where the far right actually has a history of trying to join in and sort of circumvent these kind of protests. So there already has been, and there's going to be more appearances from some of these really odious characters on the far right. So the question is sort of like, how do we think about this and what to do about it? Well, one, I think that it's really important. And this is something that Die Linke, the left party in Germany, you know, which is in certainly significant crisis as a party and political organization. They have at least come out and I think said some very correct things about this. And if people want to see these videos, they're in German, so I'm not going to play them here. We've seen from members of the left party in Germany basically saying, we support the farmers' protests, one in the very direct demands that they're making, but also because the agricultural and kind of political economic policies of the CDU, of the current coalition government, have been devastating for everyday folk. And that needs to change, right? I think that's the correct stance on this. And all while echoing the call that the farmers are worried of the attempt by the far right to try to infiltrate, steer, and take over these kind of movements. And I think that's just a perfect kind of baseline position to take, you know, on when it comes to something like this. That's basically my position on it, you know, because you can get into some complicated things about, you know, the class nature of the protest, right? Because some of these farmers are small landholders to large landholders. You know, is socialism something that we can sort of cultivate amongst the agricultural industry? Right? Those are all different questions. But when you see people reacting against austerity, reacting against the center-right consensus, reacting against the noose that Germany has tied around their neck by denying themselves the ability to have fiscal space to produce and provide for people, you should not be joining in with the center-right and the center-left in scolding people who are out there marching, right? That doesn't mean that you become a tailist, right? Which means, oh, I'm seeing this thing that is not orchestrated by the left, that's not orchestrated by the unions, not orchestrated by the socialist movement, and we're just going to sort of follow it, right? No, actively doing the work of saying, hey, this is what our program is, this is why we support you, and doing that kind of thing. And the left, I'm trying to expand even here from Germany. The left is fucking really bad at that. They let the right wing take over these kind of things all the goddamn time, because all it takes is for one kind of video to drop, one nasty person, one slogan, one thing, before the left says, hey, we're not going to fight for these folks and are going to join up with the liberals or the other forces in society that are, you know, are going to be attacking them. That's a bad tendency, because it allows the right to fester. And it allows the right to seem like they actually legitimately represent the voices and frustrations of the people. Because the right wing has no interest, not even just because the right wing is cynical or anything like that, but because the right wing in Germany, just like the right wing in the United States, is beholden to the same capitalist forces as the forces that are in power right now. So the right doesn't want to see sensible agricultural policy, equitable green transition, or anything like that. So you can't allow them to start pretending to be the voices of people. I mean, there's a lot more in there, and I'm sure I would like to, you know, speak to some of our German comrades a little bit more. But I just want to give people a kind of general breakdown and throw to you, Matt. And then we have some fun things to visit to with kind of American paranoia around these things.
Yeah, I'm excited for that.
Okay. So anyways, you know, we'll do more on this. It's, you know, there'll be more stories and things like that to see where it goes. But
yeah, I mean, we saw this with the Netherlands. I mean, Russell Brand was tailing that. I think it was last spring. I think the conversation around these things, one, it just needs to be, like you say, like participating in a way that isn't just showing solidarity with like the fucking German austerity regime, right? Like it needs to be elaborated in a way that's distinct.
I mean, I think that I'll just say this. This is a general kind of point that socialists should be able to make, is when you see kind of movements like this, you should ask yourself, what is it that people are moving about? Where does this sort of fit in with our vision of the world? And how can we use this as a kind of political education moment? How can we use this to weaken the power of our enemies, weaken the power of capital? And it's something that the left, frankly, and I think it's because they've sort of evacuated a lot of their class base. A lot of the left kind of culturally and economically is very similar to the center left, that they become very timid about doing those kind of things. And I think it's a really dangerous thing, as you see that the right is very, very capable of trying to co-opt anything. And going back to the kind of the reason we want to bring this up, is the right's all over this shit. As I open up the segment, we talked a little bit about how the right wing is already over it. People like Peter Sweden, all these kind of white nationalist accounts have been like, look, this is the people are rising up in Germany, right? Already trying to put on a kind of white nationalist far right bent on it. And let's be very clear. There are already elements of that out there. AfD, Alternative for Deutschland, has been there at the protest. And that's why I think it's very important, for example, for the Party of the Left in Germany and other kind of left organizations to be showing up in the way that they have been. But anyway, the right is trying to, you know, jump onto this kind of thing, just like they've done with all sorts of movements. And I just love this one, this clip that we're going to play here. This is from a kind of right wing TikTok dude, because it hits like a few kind of classic tropes of the weird misinformation, or what's the fancy word for it? Sensationalization of these kind of things. So anyways, we'll play this and react to it a little bit.
Hey, who's been paying attention to what's been happening in Germany? Or I guess better question is, who's missed it? Because not surprisingly, it's not...
Okay, we really will just sort of let this go because it is short. But this is... actually, before we even get to the rest of it, Matt, can we just start on this classic fucking thing?
This is the dominant register that all this shit is spoken in, especially Russell Brand. Like, all you need to do is look at his thumbnails and titles, be like, what is, there's been no discussion of this. It's like, can we skip that part? Like, we get it. Like, yes, we have capitalist media that doesn't focus on the right things. Great. Can we, like, get to the point where you're giving us details and information about this, or does it have to be like, interesting how informed I am and nobody else is paying attention to this. Like, people have been paying attention to this. What the fuck are you talking about? Like, maybe I would wonder if on that guy's feed he has posted anything about Gaza, for instance. Mm-hmm. But yeah, anyway.
No, I mean, look, I think that it's even worse, though, Matt, than I don't even think you can even give these folks like the critique of the corporate media, because what it really is just like, hey, you're not interacting with like the news media at all. Now, I'm not going to sit here and like say that the New York Times or CNN or any of these kind of major organizations are like doing a good job. Don't get me wrong here. But why have you not heard? Well, it's because you're not fucking reading the news in the first place. Right? Yeah, exactly. It's like you get these things when they come across your TikTok feed. It's not some grand conspiracy to hide this shit from you. And then you're going to get a very wild and sensationalized version of it. Hear from these guys. Anyway,
That is a hilarious response to like, damn, this significant thing I haven't heard about before. It's being hidden to me, as opposed to, no, motherfucker, you got to tune in.
So anyway, there's a personal pet peeve of mine. But this, again, it really does, because so much of I would like to maybe do something on this program or read someone else who wants to do a deep dive in it. There is a kind of like paranoid right wing movement in this country, I think, globally, right? And you can argue that like right wing stuff is always sort of paranoid, but there is something that is sort of like buzzy on social media, at least. It's like, you know, there's this grand conspiracy. It's very Alex Jonesy, right? There's this grand conspiracy of folks trying to keep the information from the people, and we're coming out here giving you the actual information, versus like sort of like, hey, there's a bad group of folks in power. It's actually like there is like a alternate reality project going on. And anyways, this is something that's very popular. But anyways, let's look at this for a second. Oh, sorry. I was watching that myself. Oh, there you go.
I guess better question is, who's missed it? Because not surprisingly, it's not getting very much coverage here. I guess they don't want anyone getting any ideas. You know what I mean? German farmers have been protesting against their government due to removal of tax benefits. Specifically those that would end the tax break on their fuel and agricultural vehicles. This is amounting to a financial impact to the farmers of what they're saying is approximately 1 billion euro per year. And this is to help resolve a 17 billion euro deficit due to what the courts have ruled, what the German courts have ruled was unlawful spending.
Okay. So before we go any further, I mean, if you watched the segment before that we just did on Left Reckoning 152, you know, by the way, what this unlawful spending thing, and if I need to explain it again, I will just really briefly. The Germans have created this absurd system that doesn't allow them to do debt spending. So when they put forward this most recent budget, they were going to dip into some money that was not spent from the pandemic. right? Which they, in my opinion, 100% should be able to. But very controversially, by the way, in Germany, by the way, the courts blocked it and said that the budget was illegal, right? So again, this is the German government's and the German political system's adherence to dangerous and devastating austerity that's baked into their political system, right? You know, something great, you know, very important to be upset about and be annoyed by. But in this video, right, and this is why these guys drive me nuts, it's, you know, some kind of secret save the day superhero came in to stop the government from doing something evil. When in fact, the reason that the government right now is doing austerity is because the government is pledged to doing balanced budget spending, which is, by the way, what the American fucking right wing wants us to do in this country.
Yeah. Can you say when Robbie Soav flames out and they stop paying his salary over at the Hill and they have some money to spend, hire like 8 of these guys. I want to see them produce an actual show every day.
That would actually be really funny. We should do, and we could just raise some money to do it for them. All right, here we go.
Of money by their government. So what's the government do? They go, oh, okay. Well, we'll just tax the people to make up the difference because we don't know how to handle money. Man, does that sound familiar? And this has been their response. You know, recently, as a couple of days ago, the German government has come back and said, okay, fine. We will spread the tax impact over some years and allow the farming sector to get used to it. Well, this isn't acceptable to the farming community in Germany. And they are not backing down. They're going to continue their protests.
Okay. So, you know, it's being saved by the patriots. I mean, look, there's just like a fundamental, and maybe I'm being a nerd here, but like there's a fundamental contradiction here. So basically what is happening in Germany is a combination of two things. One, a devotion to avoiding debt and government spending by any means necessary, right? Which is devastating the German population. I agree with that. What is the government doing? It's doing austerity. So it's cutting social programs and social spending, which, is that sort of what the American right wing wants to do in this country? Right. So the idea that like, this is some ideology that is so foreign to the American kind of Trumpian movement is so insane to me.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, and it's funny how they will, that like they wouldn't like workers striking is not something like they would, a guy like that would be as supportive of. You know, it's get back to work. A lot of people would like that job, but these guys and like truckers here in America too. It's like yes, the government. And it sounds rational, right? Like you are important to our economy. You know, it's not like some, you know, speculators in financial markets or whatever. Y'all are bringing food to market, right? People are getting fed. So, okay, maybe we give you a subsidy for your fuel, right? Like that makes sense. But like that is a capital sector being preferred by the government. Like there's no like libertarianism here, like that's all gone. It's kind of fascinating to me.
That's what I'm saying. It's so like it's at its heart is it's like irrational and emotional, right? You start off which is like, well, there's a big conspiracy to hide this information from you, and then basically what are people reacting to? Well, it's the kind of shit that I would like to see happening in this country. Anyway, I think Matt and I should do a little bit more on this because I think this style of video making and actually needs some more uncovering. But folks,
we should do videos like that. I need to just like.
I mean, I keep on thinking about doing videos in my truck. I know. I think I should start.
I would have to like. You know how people have you seen this thing where people will? And I actually think there's a studio near me in Brooklyn. Where you can go in and they have different sets, and famously one looks like you're on a jet. So if you look closely, whenever you see something that takes place on a plane on TikTok or whatever, or Instagram, whether it's somebody like looking like very cool and luxurious, or something that like it's some so interaction, absurd. Yeah, that like, wait, that's very strange behavior. It might be in one of these things, but I would need like one that looks like I'm in an F-150 or something, like in my apartment, just be like,
no, I 100%.
You have the whole set.
I did one in the truck when remember we got banned from YouTube for like 2 weeks?
Oh yeah.
Because of the vaccine. we did a Crowder video and they banned us from YouTube for 2 weeks. I did a call to action while driving the truck. Hoping that could maybe get us some more eyes. But yeah, we'll bring that back. Well, anyways, folks,
nobody's talking about this and look very as somebody commented.
Nobody's talking about this.
It's the Reserve Army of Labor.
we should do a whole series on it. That's a great idea. Just intro to Marxism. Nobody's talking about this. There's this fella out there from Germany who had some really wild ideas.
They don't want you to get any ideas.
So dangerous. He tried to come to Texas, and they actually blocked him from coming. You know that story? Karl Marx tried to immigrate to America, to Texas particularly, and they wouldn't let him. This man tried to come to Texas to help us out, and they wouldn't let him in. I think it's a really important thing for us to uncover the secret message of this young fella from Chair. All right, folks. Well, we're going to go over the post game, maybe workshop that a little bit more. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning. It's a whole other episode. You want to be joining us for that. We'll be taking some questions from our good listeners and friends out there. We'll be back this Sunday with a bonus episode for all of y'all. Thank you so much for coming out and hanging out with us tonight. Looking forward to 2024. It's going to be a lot more election coverage, but I think we'll make it through, Matt. It'll be fun.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be so much fun. I can't. The election. I love it. Folks, we're going to talk a little bit about Bill Ackman, who is the he's this big money guy who tried about 15 years ago. I remember hearing about him because he was trying to short trade a pyramid scheme called Herbalife, which is a pyramid scheme, but he failed nonetheless. And I think lost that bet. But anyway, he has got his wife in trouble, based on his, this Claudine Gay stuff, which we haven't talked about here. I'm not super interested in. I think we'll talk about this in the post game. Yeah. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning, to get access to that.
See y'all soon.
Peace.